commentator Richard Farrell has reasons of his own for tracking events in Afghanistan.
I'm a heroin addict, and I feel as if a piece of my heart is going to war in Afghanistan. I'm not using anymore, but this war and my addiction are horribly intertwined. You see, my 23-year-old son William is a member of the United States Navy's Elite Mobile Unit 11. The unit is heading for a newly constructed base in Afghanistan, and the enemy they'll face has everything to do with heroin. The Taliban funds terrorism with millions of dollars from the opium trade. Afghanistan supplies most of the world's heroin. It has been 22 years since I methodically unwrapped a tiny plastic bag of heroin, tossed the white powder into a cooker, and fired it into my veins. I remember sitting in detox, shaking with panic attacks, gagging, trying desperately to survive just another minute. I used to have nightmares about a 6-foot needle chasing me in and out of the shadows. Now, because of William's mission, I feel heroin nipping at my heels again. The panic attacks are coming on strong. I do my best to forget that my boy is going to war, but the nightly news reminds me. American soldiers, young boys, killed by roadside bombs. I see William's face instead, and instantly my brain rewinds to when he was 12. I watch him run wild on a football field in Lowell, Massachusetts. Then I see his boots hit the ground in Afghanistan. I'm deeply troubled, wondering if my son will be trying to wipe out the crop that nearly killed me 22 years ago. Back then, I was an involuntary customer who helped create a demand for the drug. I was the last link in a system that produced and distributed heroin, the very system my son William will be trying to break. Last night, my detox nightmare came back. This time, though, it's not a needle full of heroin chasing me. Instead, it's an AK-47 Guerrilla rifle's bullet, an IED tucked neatly under loose gravel, or an RPG moving quickly through the air. It's after my son William. I wake up just before it takes him out. Some mornings, the thought of the future brings me to tears. Heroin snatched away William's childhood. Heroin's power destroyed his family. Now, 22 years later, in a very different way, heroin has another chance to break my heart. And frankly, I'm not sure if I'd recover this time around.
Richard Farrell is author of What's Left of Us, A Memoir of Addiction. You can comment on the opinion page at npr.org. This month, Jay Leno starts his highly anticipated new gig as host of a 10 o'clock show on NBC. Of course, Leno's most well-known for being the king of late night as host of The Tonight Show. But this morning, we're going to take a look back at the time and place where Leno and many other big-name comedians got their start, Los Angeles in the 1970s.
I'm originally from the East. I've been living out here about 4 months. You know, I can't get used to living out here. I don't know how many of you are from New York. The beach is on the wrong side.
That was Leno with black hair and a plaid shirt, same big chin, right after he arrived in L.A. so poor that the police picked him up, thinking he was homeless. Another young comedian came to L.A. a few months later from Indiana. His name was David Letterman.
I just got back from Reno, stayed at a condominium up there, and really a cheap condominium. Had one of those whirlpools, you know what a whirlpool jacuzzi is? I think it was a cheap jacuzzi, though, because when everybody got in the water, we had to take turns going...
Leno and Letterman were joined by Robin Williams, Andy Kaufman, Richard Lewis, and many other household names-to-be during what our guest calls stand-up comedy's golden era. Bill Nadelsieder was a reporter for the LA Times at the time. He was covering the burgeoning comedy scene, and his new book is called I'm Dying Up Here: Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Why do you call the stand-up comedy's golden era?
Well, in Los Angeles, people were arriving by the week from all around the country. You know, class clowns from all over the place just picked up and moved. invariably inspired by sitting there watching the Tonight Show and hearing Johnny Carson say, now here's a young comic who's appearing here in town at the Comedy Store. And boom, that was it. They heard that and they packed their bags and headed to L.A. thinking that if they just got on this stage at this place called the Comedy Store, well, they would be on Carson and they would be comedians. Before long, you had 300, young comics living in West Hollywood around the Comedy Store trying to get on that stage.
But Los Angeles was not always the hub for comedy. Early in your book, you talk about Johnny Carson moving The Tonight Show from New York to the West Coast.
Well, that was the most significant thing because Johnny Carson was the prime arbiter of what was funny in America for a very long time. If he thought you were funny and put you on his show, you had a career. If he didn't, you didn't have a career.
This world that you write about was so densely packed with talent. What impact did that tight-knit community have on the comedy that these guys were doing?
It was absolutely electric, and they would all share stuff, and they would write stuff down on napkins, and they'd be hanging out at the bar between sets. I mean, and, it's hard to imagine now, but that you on a random Friday night, you could see Letterman and Leno and Richard Lewis and Robin Williams and Elaine Boozler all on the same stage.
Will you read a passage from the book that kind of captures a bit of that sense? This is on page 106.
Ringo Starr made a memorable solo appearance at Sunset one night, arriving so intoxicated that Mike Binder, who was working the door, had to help him to a seat and back. Starr was seated just as David Letterman took the stage, and the former Beatle immediately began heckling him, which attracted the attention of every comic with an earshot. Letterman had a reputation for eviscerating hecklers, and as word spread along the back hallway, other comics started filing into the room to watch the impending bloodshed. It wasn't a fair fight. In the spotlight, Letterman couldn't see who the heckler was, so he showed no mercy, and Starr was too drunk to appreciate how badly Letterman was beating him up. Finally, one of the comics took pity and called out, "Hey, Dave, it's Ringo." "Oh, that makes sense," Letterman shot back in the direction of Starr. "You ruined your career, and now you've come here to ruin mine." George Miller almost fell off his stool laughing.
Were you there that night?
No, I was not. I was there on other nights, but not that one.
In the center of this book, you have a collection of photographs, and there's one that I just have to ask you about. It shows Andy Kaufman posturing in a full-length robe that looks like it could be made out of silk. The caption on the photo says, "Andy Kaufman getting ready to wrestle on the author's patio, November 1978.
Okay.
What's the story?
All right. I was set to do a profile on Andy for the LA Times. And we had the interview set up for a couple of days ahead. And one night around 7 or 8 o'clock, my phone rang. And, "Hi, it's Andy. Can I come over?" And I was sort of taking it back. "Well, sure. Come on over." And about a half an hour later, Andy Kaufman showed up at my front door, and he had a cardboard vaudevillian suitcase with him. And he insisted on performing his entire act in pantomime while I took pictures, complete with three costume changes.
An audience of one.
Myself and my wife, who was 8 months pregnant at the time. And he wanted to wrestle her. And that was
his.
No. No. But there is a funny picture of him, staring her down like he was going to wrestle her.
So many of the people you write about in this book died before their time. Is it difficult to see the immense talent that is no longer with us?
Yeah. Well, that sort of happened with that generation in comedy and rock and roll. I think there was probably more drugs in the rock and roll arena.
You write about all-night cocaine sessions with the comedians.
Yep, that did happen. But it wasn't part of the comedy lifestyle. There were some who did that. There were a lot of them who didn't. I mean, Jay Leno was an absolute straight arrow. Letterman, they didn't do that. Comics didn't make enough money to buy cocaine. They were lucky to buy pot.
Robin Williams had the line that cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money.
A very true statement.
Well, we're having this conversation on the eve of Jay Leno's new show. It would seem appropriate to go out with a clip of his first ever appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
See, my folks grew up during the Depression. So consequently, they make you feel very guilty about everything, I mean, even now I go home for a weekend. "Hey, Dad, pass the salt."
"We never had salt when we were kids. We had to live without salt. We didn't have underwear or potatoes. We ate dirt every day of the week. Your mother and I hunted wild dog for food. We had nothing when we were your age."
Bill Nadelsedr, what do you think?
I remember that Jay Leno. He told me this. He said, you know, that he could sell a joke that really wasn't that funny because he had a lot of attitude and he could with his voice and all that. Letterman didn't quite have that brio, so he had to write better jokes was the issue. They were sort of a mutual admiration society back then. In separate interviews, I asked each of them, okay, so, you know, whose act among your peers do you most admire? And each of them instantly named the other.
Bill Nadelsieder, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bill Nadelsieder is the author of I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. And you'll find clips of Leno and Letterman's early performances in L.A., plus an excerpt of William Nadelsieder's new book on our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montagne. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Here's one way to cut carbon emissions. Bury the stuff in farm fields. The Senate is considering a plan that would pay farmers to do just that as part of a climate and energy bill. The bill would essentially raise the cost of any fuel that emits carbon dioxide, the main contributor to climate change. As a result, farmers would see higher prices for their fuel and fertilizer. The payments for burying the carbon on their land would soften the blow, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The American Clean Energy and Security Act aims to make companies reduce the amount of carbon dioxide they emit or be penalized. Reducing emissions can be hard and expensive, so the bill creates something called an offset. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail card in Monopoly. A company could offset its emissions by paying someone else to get rid of carbon instead, someone who can do it more cheaply. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack recently told Congress that farmers would be delighted to get paid to store some of that carbon.
They'll be able, through the use of land, through cover crops, through altering how they use fertilizer, to how they raise livestock, to what they do with their land. I mean, there are a series of steps that can be taken and will be taken that will generate opportunities for offsets.
A good place to store carbon is in dirt, something farmers have a lot of. Dirt is full of organic matter, plant residue, microorganisms, earthworms. It's chock full of carbon. And theoretically, if you don't till the field, more of the carbon stays put. Guided by that belief, members of Congress want to allow farmers to sell offsets earned by no-till farming. Does it work? Scientists say maybe.
My name is Michelle Cavagelli. I'm a soil scientist with the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland.
Cavagelli shows me a no-till plot.
We have a corn crop on our left, and we have a soybean crop on our right. We might want to go inside the field a little bit. Okay, so I'm digging up the soil. You'll notice that when I break it apart, it breaks apart relatively easily. It's not a hard block like a brick.
Compared to a plowed field, this one has lots of dead vegetation in and on top of the dirt.
The percentage of organic matter in this soil, for example, is 2%. Twice as much as in some of the tilled systems at the very surface.
At the surface and down to about 4 inches or so. And the carbon will stay put if it isn't plowed. Plowing exposes the soil's organic matter to the air. It breaks down and the carbon goes up into the atmosphere.
If you till it, you can lose almost all the carbon you gained in the previous 5 years, say, with one tillage even. So one of the challenges is to maintain your no-till fields forever, in essence, to really gain the benefits of carbon sequestration.
But that doesn't fit in with the kind of no-till that most American farmers practice.
The reason is farmers plow 1 year and they do the no-till next year.
That's Ratan Lal, a soil scientist at Ohio State University. Moreover, Lal says research finds that no-till fields actually don't store any more carbon than plowed fields if you look deeper, say 3 feet down. So, do no-till fields really qualify as carbon offsets? Lal says they can store more carbon than a plowed field if the conditions are just right, the right kind of soil and soil temperature, for example. There's a possible conflict brewing here, though. Federal law and the energy bill encourage farmers to remove crop residue to make ethanol. And, says Lal,
that's a no-no. The moment you take the crop residue away, the benefits on no-till farming, on erosion control, water conservation, on carbon sequestration will not be realized.
Nonetheless, Lal supports no-till for carbon offsets, mostly because of how no-till fields are planted. When you don't plow, you use less fossil fuel to run equipment and make fertilizer.
Saving in diesel, saving in labor, saving in fertilizer consumption, saving in time.
These savings mean that no-till has a smaller carbon footprint than plowing. Farm interests are eager to win offsets for farmers, in part because they say the energy bill will raise their fuel costs across the board. The final list of what will be allowed in the bill could help win supporters when the Senate votes on the measure. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
College freshmen are told over and over how important getting a degree is, but as many as half of the students who start college never graduate. And colleges are struggling to find ways of keeping students around up to the day they get their diplomas. NPR's Larry Abramson has this profile of efforts at one school, Millersville University in Pennsylvania.
Professor Ralph Antonin is 69 years old. He says even when he went to college, faculty were aware that many students would never finish.
Scared the hell out of me when he said, look to your left, look to your right, one of you won't be here next semester.
Antonin says back then schools felt there was little they could do about this. Now getting students to graduate has become job one. Doc Antonin, as he's known, teaches at Millersville University, and he is the chief evangelist for getting students to graduate from this public institution outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Antonin says that in theory, retention, holding on to students, is simple.
It's establishing a bond between that student and something in the institution, be it a person, a program, a club, an activity.
But actually creating that bond with a bunch of teenagers is anything but easy. One of the first activities that freshmen at Millersville experience is the freshman seminar, a key part of orientation, which was in full swing when I visited. These students are meeting for the first time with Professor Dan O'Neill for a class on homelessness.
What does it really mean to be homeless? And why does that happen in this country? What's the history?
The homelessness course is not graded. It's primarily meant to help integrate freshmen into their roles as college students and as citizens of the Lancaster area. O'Neill also serves as the student's advisor. He uses the class as a way to probe their strengths and weaknesses.
Study skills, we take time to talk about time management, social issues that come up, alcohol, sexual issues that might come up during the first semester.
Risk factor number one here is being an undeclared freshman in the first place. They are viewed as a threatened species with no firm interest to guide them. They're more likely to be upset by the loss of a high school relationship or by bad grades in college. Millersville President Fran McNary says students at state schools like this one are more likely to drift away than those chosen by selective institutions.
It's easy to be able to retain and graduate the best and the brightest.
Some Ivy League schools hand degrees to over 90% of their students, but that's after they've picked the applicants most likely to succeed. Millersville has to admit most of the students who apply here. Still, thanks to its efforts at retention, this state school has a graduation rate that is much higher than similar schools. President McNary says she's investing in retention efforts because it's the right thing to do and because it saves money.
When you lose a student, you then have to replace a student. That costs even more because you probably need to recruit at least three or four students to replace one student.
So McNary says she tries to make it everyone's mission here to hold on to students. That includes dorm staff, who might be the first people to notice that a young person is depressed. And it includes the counseling service. Director Kelsey Backel says she is already seeing the first signs of a malady that drives many new arrivals home.
Every day this week, we've had one of our counselors on call in the office for homesick students, and we had one yesterday who came Tuesday and is ready to leave on Wednesday.
During orientation, Millersville students are counseled, they're pep-talked, they're warned about every possible risk to their futures. Freshman Jessica Wall of Palmyra, Pennsylvania, says it's, well,
boring, because it is a lot of the same thing over and over again. But it makes sense. It'll definitely be beneficial in the long run.
Some of these retention programs are paying off, but the challenge is growing as schools accept more students with special challenges, those with learning problems or who are attending college for the first time, and those who are coming directly to college from the military under the new GI Bill. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The federal government keeps a registry of nurses, nurses' aides, and pharmacists who have been disciplined for things like stealing drugs and abusing patients. When hospitals and nursing homes hire staff, they would like to check that database, but they can't. NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
The federal registry is called the Healthcare Integrity and Protection Data Bank. Congress created it 22 years ago and intended it to be open to hospitals and many nursing homes that wanted to run background checks. But the Department of Health and Human Services never completed the necessary regulation to make the registry available. So the names in the data bank stay secret.
There's really no reason for it at all.
Dr. Sidney Wolf is with the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. He notes that there's also a separate national data bank of doctors who've been disciplined, and that list can be checked by hospitals, unlike the one for nurses.
I mean, there are probably more records of disciplined nurses and nurses' aides than there are disciplined doctors, except the doctor stuff is in the data bank, accessible to hospitals. The nurses, nurses' aides, and pharmacists are secret right now.
Wolf is pushing to change that. He's asked Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to let hospitals and some nursing homes get access to the list of disciplined healthcare workers. There are more than 100,000 names on the registry. Wolf says many of them may still have jobs in healthcare.
Until the government makes these data available, patients are going to be injured in hospitals by nurses, nurses' aides, who shouldn't be on the staff of the hospital. The only reason they're on the staff is when the hospital hired them, they didn't know what their past record was.
So all this raises the question, what stopped the data bank from being made available? If you think there must be powerful interests lined up against it, you're wrong. Nurses support it. Rebecca Patton is president of the American Nurses Association.
We believe that this registry is a good registry, and we believe that impaired, unsafe nurses should be addressed and the public should be protected from those situations.
Hospitals and nursing homes could use a federal data bank to run accurate background checks, in addition to counting on state discipline records. Nancy Foster is with the American Hospital Association.
This database would likely not be something we would rely on as the only source of information, but it would be one source of information we might check to make sure we don't miss a vital piece of information about a person we're going to hire to care for the patients we serve.
So the culprit for years of delay turns out to be slow-moving government bureaucracy. In 2006, the Department of Health and Human Services started the process of writing a regulation. It got public comment and reactions from 7 or 8 government agencies. A year ago in the Bush administration, the department finished the regulation. But then the White House froze it and said it should be up to the new president to decide. So it's all under review again. A spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services says things are on track and that maybe by early next year, the department will open the registry of disciplined nurses, aides, and pharmacists. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
ABC News became its own lead story yesterday when it announced that Charlie Gibson, the anchor of World News Tonight, would be retiring in January. And following Gibson in the anchor chair will be Diane Sawyer. The change in anchors came so unexpectedly that ABC doesn't have a replacement for Sawyer on Good Morning America. Bill Carter reports on the media world for the New York Times, and he joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, that was your reporting about ABC not having a replacement for Sawyer. Were you surprised by this news?
Well, I was caught by surprise in the sense that it didn't seem like it was imminent. I was not surprised that Charlie Gibson stepped down necessarily because he's kind of been talking about that for several years. Even before he got this position, he had made a plan to retire. And because of the circumstances at ABC, when Peter Jennings died and then they had the accident with Bob Woodruff, he was called in. So he would have retired except for that. So it's not surprising that he sort of decided to step down.
But ABC did expect and hope he would stay longer at least.
Yes, and they actually did ask him to reconsider. And when he broached this at the beginning of the summer, they had continuing talks to see if he could relent a little and maybe stay a little bit longer. So I think from their point of view, because of what the implications are of moving Diane Sawyer especially, they really would much rather a continued status quo for quite a while.
And the implications are both what's she going to do in the evening news, that could be a problem or a positive, I guess, and what are they going to do about the morning show?
I think they're much less concerned about what happens in the evening news. I think they expect they'll be quite fine there. There are a lot of advantages they have in the evening news that'll keep them, in, you know, certainly competitive. But in the morning, you know, they've been falling farther and farther behind the Today Show, NBC's Today Show. And really, Diane Sawyer has been the main attraction on that morning show for quite a long time. They don't really have what, you know, would be called a star in the rest of that cast. And replacing her really is problematic because there's not an obvious choice.
Well, you know, though, speaking of the evening news, it's interesting that you say that you believe they don't think they have a problem there. Network evening news has not been kind to the handful of women who've ascended to the anchor chair. In fact, some have been savaged, like Barbara Walters and Connie Chung.
That is quite true, of course. And no woman has really stood out when they've been named to this position. I'm not sure that Katie Couric's performance has a lot to do with the fact that she's a woman. I think CBS was trailing anyway when they had Dan Rather and hoped she could turn it around. She hasn't, but there's a lot of outside factors, like CBS local stations are much weaker than the other two networks, so the lead-ins to her newscast are not very good. She can't overcome that, and that's been, you know, bad for her, you know, because people have said, you know, she hasn't been able to solve their problem. But I don't think Diane Sawyer will be quite as hampered. I think she has the advantages of very strong ABC stations, very strong lead-ins from the Oprah Winfrey Show in the evenings. So she should have an advantage. But if she doesn't succeed at it or falls well behind what Gibson was doing, it will be sort of reflective on whether or not women can succeed in this role.
Well, we just have a couple of seconds left here, but what do you think they'll do in the morning show?
I think they're going to have to reach for an outside person. I don't think there's an inside person at ABC who's a logical choice. I think they're going to have to really find maybe somebody that we don't see on the radar right now, because the people that are logical, Ann Curry, for example, would be the obvious choice if they could get her away from the Today Show.
Right.
She's locked up on a long-term contract. So the ones that are most logical are on long-term contracts, which, again, is a reason why they should have maybe planned this out a little better.
Thanks very much. Bill Carter covers media for The New York Times. And this is NPR News.